having indulged until the age of 16 with unusual immoderation in the vice, to which Jean-Jacques Rousseau confessed, I ceased doing so at the age of 17, just as soon as I so decided. I'm always master of myself when I want to be. And so take it that I don't want to put the responsibility for my crimes either on my environment or my illness. When the beating was over, I put the penknife into my waistcoat pocket, went out, and threw it on the street far away from the house so no one would ever know. Then I waited 2 days. The girl, after having a good cry, became even more taciturn, but I'm sure she harbored no ill will towards me. However, she must have felt some disgrace at having been punished that way with me there. She hadn't screamed when she was hit, only sobbed, no doubt because I was standing there watching it all. But like a child, she blamed only herself for her disgrace. Up to this point, she was probably still afraid of me, not of me personally, but as a lodger, a stranger. Apparently she was also very shy. And so, during those 2 days, I did actually ask myself the question, could I abandon a certain plan I had conceived? And I immediately felt I could, at any time and any moment. Just about then, I was thinking of killing myself because of my morbid indifference. Well, I'm not really sure why. During those 2 or 3 days, since it was absolutely necessary to wait until the girl had forgotten everything, probably to distract myself from a persistent fantasy or else just for the fun of it, I committed a theft in our apartment. It was the only theft I've committed in my whole life. There was a large number of people living in the apartment. Among them was a civil servant who lived with his family in 2 furnished rooms. He was about 40, not altogether stupid, with a decent appearance, but rather poor. I didn't make friends with him, and he was afraid of the company that surrounded me there. He'd just received his salary, about 35 rubles. The thing that goaded me on was that I actually needed some money then, even though I received some in the post 4 days later. So I stole out of necessity, as it were, and not for fun. It was done quite brazenly and openly. I simply went into his room when he was eating with his wife and children in another room. There on a chair near the door lay his crumpled uniform. A thought had suddenly flashed into my mind in the corridor. I thrust my hand into the pocket and pulled out his wallet. But the civil servant heard the rustling and glanced through from the other room. I think he actually saw at least something, but not everything, so of course he couldn't believe his eyes. I said I was passing through the corridor, and I looked in to see what time it was on his clock. It stopped, he said, and I withdrew. Then I drank, rather heavily. There was a large crowd assembled in my room, including Lebyadkin. I threw away the wallet with the change, but kept the bills. There were 32 rubles, 3 red bills and 2 yellow ones. I changed a red bill at once and sent out for some champagne. Then I changed the second one, and finally the third. About 4 hours later, in the evening, the civil servant was waiting for me in the corridor. Nikolai Vsevolodovich, when you came into my room not long ago, did you by any chance happen to knock my uniform off the chair near the door that it was lying on?
No, I don't recall. Was it there?
Yes, it was.
On the floor?
At first on the chair, then the floor.
Did you pick it up?
Yes.
Well, what do you want, then?
If that's the case, then nothing. He dared not speak out, and dared not tell anyone else in the apartment. That's how timid these people are. Besides, everyone there was terribly afraid of me and respected me. Afterwards, I enjoyed meeting his eye a few times in the corridor. Soon, I grew bored with it. After 3 days, I returned to my lodgings on Gorokhovaya Street. The mother was carrying a bundle and about to go out. Her husband was not at home, of course. Matryosha and I were left alone. The windows were open. There were many artisans living in the house, and the sound of hammers and singing went on all day long. We'd been there for about an hour. Matryosha sat on a bench in her little room with her back to me, poking at something with her needle. At last she suddenly began singing, very, very softly. Sometimes she used to do that. I took out my watch to see what time it was. It was 2 o'clock. My heart started to pound. But then I suddenly posed myself the question once more, could I stop? And answered at once, yes, I could. I stood up and started to sneak up on her. There were a lot of geraniums on the windowsill, and the sun was shining very brightly. I sat down next to her on the floor, very quietly. She started and was extremely frightened at first and jumped up. I took hold of her hand, kissed it gently, made her sit down on the bench again, and began to gaze into her eyes. My kissing her hand suddenly amused her like a little child, but only for a second, because she soon tried to jump up again and was in such a fright that a tremor passed across her face. She looked at me in terror with staring eyes. Her lips began to quiver, as if she were going to cry, but still she didn't call out. I began kissing her hand again. I took her onto my lap and kissed her face and her feet. As I was kissing her feet, she drew right back and smiled as if in shame, but her smile was somehow crooked. Her whole face was flushed with embarrassment. I kept whispering something to her. Finally, there occurred something so strange that I shall never forget it, something that quite astonished me. This little girl put her arms around my neck and suddenly began kissing me wildly. Her face expressed absolute rapture. I almost stood up and left out of pity. I found it so unpleasant in such a young creature. But I overcame this sudden feeling of fear and stayed. When it was all over, she was very embarrassed. I didn't try to reassure her and no longer caressed her. She stared at me, smiling timidly. Her face suddenly seemed stupid. Her feeling of embarrassment grew rapidly with every passing minute. At last, she covered her face with her hands and stood in a corner, motionless, her face to the wall. I was afraid she'd get frightened again, as she had before, and I left the house in silence. I suppose all that had happened must finally have seemed to her an immense abomination, a mortal horror. In spite of the Russian swear words, which she must have heard since she was a baby, and all sorts of strange conversations, I'm absolutely convinced she still knew nothing. She probably felt in the end that she'd committed an enormous crime and was guilty of a mortal sin. She'd killed God. That night I had the brawl in the tavern, which I mentioned in passing. But I awoke the next morning in my own room, where Lebyadkin had brought me. My first thought on waking up was the following: had she told anyone or not? This was a moment of genuine fear, though not very intense. I was very cheerful that morning and very kind to everyone. My whole crowd seemed very pleased with me. But I left them all and returned to my lodging on Gorokhovyo Street. I encountered her downstairs in the entrance hall. She was coming home from a shop where she'd been sent for some chicory. When she saw me, she shot upstairs in terror. When I came in, her mother had already hit her twice across the face because she'd come running into the room at breakneck speed, and that concealed the real reason for her fear. And so everything was calm for the moment. She hid away somewhere and didn't come in all the time I was there. I stayed for about an hour and then left. Towards evening I began to feel afraid again, but this time the feeling was incomparably more intense. Of course I could deny it all, but they might prove my guilt. I was haunted by the idea of imprisonment. I'd never felt fear, and except for this one episode in my life, neither before nor after was I ever afraid of anything. Especially not Siberia, even though I could have been sent there on more than one occasion. But this time I was frightened and felt genuine fear, I don't know why, for the first time in my life. A very painful feeling. Besides, that evening in my own room, I conceived such a hatred for her that I resolved to kill her. The recollection of her smile was the main cause of my hatred. I conceived contempt mixed with intense loathing for her because, after it was all over, she had rushed off to the corner of the room and covered her face with her hands. I was overcome by inexplicable rage. Then I suffered from a chill. When the fever began to increase towards morning, I was overcome by fear once again, but of such intensity that I'd never experienced anything so painful. But I no longer hated the little girl. At least, my hatred didn't reach the paroxysm it had the night before. I noticed that intense fear completely obliterates hatred and the desire for revenge. I awoke around noon much better, and was quite surprised by some of the things I had felt the day before. But I was in a bad mood and was compelled to return to Gorokhovaya Street once again, in spite of all my revulsion. I recall desperately wanting to have a quarrel, a really serious one, with anyone, right then. But when I arrived at my lodgings, there in my room I suddenly found the maid, Nina Savyalivna, who'd been waiting for me for about an hour. I didn't like this woman at all, and she herself was a bit afraid I might be angry with her since she'd come without being asked. But I was suddenly very pleased to see her. She wasn't bad-looking, but was humble and had lower middle-class manners. My landlady had been singing her praises for some time. I found them having coffee together, and the landlady was delighted with their pleasant conversation. In the corner of their room, I noticed Matryosha. She stood looking at her mother and the visitor without moving. When I came in, she didn't hide as she had before and didn't run away. I merely thought she'd grown very thin and had a fever. I caressed Nina and locked the door to the landlady's apartment, which I hadn't done for some time, so Nina left feeling overjoyed. I escorted her out myself and didn't go back to Gorokhovaya Street for 2 days. I was bored with the whole affair. I decided to put an end to it all, to give up the apartment and leave Petersburg. But when I came to give up the apartment, I found the landlady in a state of anxiety and grief. Matryosha had been ill for the last 3 days. Each night she had a fever and was delirious. Of course, I asked what she said in her delirium. We spoke in my room in a whisper. She told me that her daughter uttered terrible things. "I killed God," she says. I suggested she summon a doctor at my expense, but she refused. "God willing, it'll pass. She won't stay in bed the whole time. She goes out during the day. She just ran down to the shop." I resolved to see Matryosha alone, since the landlady blurted out that she'd have to go over to the Petersburg side around 5 o'clock. I decided to come back later that evening. I had dinner in a tavern. I returned at precisely 5:15. I always used my own key to enter. No one was there besides Matryosha. She was lying on her mother's bed in her room behind the screen. I saw her look out at me, but I pretended I didn't notice. All the windows were open. The air was warm, it was even hot. I walked around the room and sat down on the sofa. I remember every moment of it. It afforded me distinct pleasure not to talk to Matryosha. I waited and sat there 1 whole hour, and suddenly she jumped up from behind the screen. I heard her 2 feet hit the floor as she jumped out of bed, followed by her rather quick footsteps. Then she stood on the threshold of my room. She looked at me in silence. In these last 4 or 5 days, during which I hadn't once seen her very closely, she'd really grown very thin. Her face had a sort of drawn look, and she was probably feverish. Her eyes appeared to have grown larger and stared at me motionlessly, as if with dull curiosity, or so it seemed to me at first. I sat there in the corner of the sofa, looked at her, and didn't move at all. Once again, I suddenly felt that hatred. But soon I noticed she wasn't the least afraid of me, and might even have been delirious. But she wasn't, in fact, delirious. She suddenly began shaking her head at me, as people do when they're reproaching you, and she suddenly raised her tiny fist and began threatening me from where she stood. At first this gesture seemed ridiculous. Then I couldn't bear it any longer. I stood up and approached her. There was a look of such despair on her face as was almost inconceivable in a child. She kept brandishing her little fist at me menacingly and shaking her head in reproach. I went up close to her and started speaking cautiously, but realized that she didn't understand. Then she suddenly covered her face impulsively with her hands, as she'd done before, walked away, and stood by the window with her back to me. I left her, returned to my own room, and sat near the window. I don't understand why I didn't leave then, and instead stayed there, waiting, as it were. Soon I heard her hurried steps again. She went out through the door onto the wooden landing at the top of the stairs. I immediately ran to my door, opened it, and just caught a glimpse of Matryosha entering a tiny storeroom, no bigger than a chicken coop, next to the lavatory. A strange idea flashed into my mind. I opened the door and returned to the window. Of course, I still couldn't believe the idea that had flashed into my mind. However, I remember everything. A minute later, I looked at my watch and noticed the time. Evening was drawing on. A fly was buzzing around me and kept landing on my face. I caught it, held it in my hand, then let it out of the window. A cart of some kind drove noisily into the courtyard below. A workman, a tailor perhaps, was singing very loudly at a window in one corner of the courtyard, and had been doing so for some time. He was working, and I could see him. It occurred to me that since no one had seen me as I'd entered the gates and climbed the stairs, of course, it'd be better if no one met me now as I was going down the stairs. I moved my chair back from the window. Then I picked up a book, but laid it aside and began staring at a tiny red spider on one of the geranium leaves and then dozed off. I remember everything, down to the last moment. Suddenly I grabbed my watch. 20 minutes had passed since she'd gone out. My hypothesis reached the stage of probability. But I decided to wait another quarter of an hour. It also occurred to me that she might have returned, and I simply hadn't heard her. But this was impossible. There was dead silence, and I could hear the buzz of every tiny fly. All of a sudden, my heart began to pound. I took out my watch. There were 3 minutes left, but I waited them out, though my heart was beating painfully. Then I stood up, put on my hat, buttoned my coat, and looked around the room to see if everything was in place, were there any signs that I'd been there. I moved the chair closer to the table where it had been before. At last I quietly opened the door, locked it with my own key, and went to the storeroom. The door was closed, but not locked. I knew that it didn't lock, but I didn't want to open it. I stood on tiptoe and looked through the chink. At this very moment, standing on tiptoe, I recalled that as I was sitting by the window staring at the red spider and had dozed off, I had thought about how I'd stand on tiptoe and put my eye to the chink in the door. By including this insignificant detail here, I want to demonstrate clearly that I was in full possession of my mental abilities. I stared through the chink for some time. It was dark there, but not totally. At last I could discern what I needed to. I wanted to be completely sure. At last I decided I could leave and went down the stairs. I didn't meet anyone. Around 3 o'clock we were sitting in our shirt sleeves, drinking tea in our rooms, playing a game with a deck of old cards, and Lebyadkin was reciting poetry. We were telling stories, and, as if on purpose, they were successful and amusing, not stupid, as was so often the case. Kirillov was there, too. No one was drinking, even though there was a bottle of rum, except for Lebyadkin, who was helping himself. Prokhor Malov once observed that, when Nikolai Vsevolodovitch is content and not depressed, our whole circle is cheerful and witty. I recalled his pronouncement at the time. But around 11 o'clock, the janitor's little girl came running in with the news from the landlady of the house on Gorokhovaya Street that Matryosha had hanged herself. I went back with the girl and realized that the landlady herself didn't know why she'd sent for me. She was howling and thrashing about. There was a great commotion, a large crowd of people, and a few policemen. I stood in the hall for a while, and then left. They hardly troubled me, although they asked me the usual questions, except for saying that the girl had been ill and delirious during the last few days, and that I'd suggested sending for a doctor at my own expense. There was really nothing more that I could say. They also asked me about the penknife. I said the landlady had given her a beating, but that was nothing unusual. No one knew that I'd come earlier that evening. I heard nothing about the results of the postmortem. For a week or so I didn't go there. I dropped in to give notice long after they had buried her. The landlady was still weeping, even though she was busy with her rags and her sewing as before. "It was me who upset her because of your penknife," she told me, but without much reproach. I settled my account with her on the pretext that I could no longer stay in that apartment and receive Nina Savyelivna. Once again, she sang Nina Savyelivna's praises at our parting. As I left, I gave her a present of an extra 5 rubles in addition to what I owed her for the apartment. In general, I found life very boring at that time. I was sick to death of it. After the danger had passed, I would have forgotten the events on Gorokhovia Street, just as I did everything else at the time, if I hadn't kept recalling with considerable anger what a coward I'd been. I vented my anger on anyone I could. It was at that time, but for no reason in particular, that I conceived the idea of crippling my life in some way, in as vile a way as possible. For a year or so, I'd been thinking about shooting myself. But then something even better occurred to me. One day, looking at the lame girl, Marya Timofeyevna Lebyadkina, who sometimes worked as a servant in my rooms and who was still not completely insane, merely an exalted idiot, and who was secretly head over heels in love with me, which my friends had discovered, I suddenly decided to marry her. The idea of a match between Stavrogin and such an outlandish creature made my nerves tingle. It was impossible to imagine anything more hideous. But I couldn't say for sure whether or not the anger at my own base cowardice that had overwhelmed me after the affair with Matryosha entered into my decision even unconsciously. Of course, unconsciously. In fact, I don't think it did. In any case, I didn't get married merely because of a bet over a bottle of wine after a drunken dinner. The witnesses at our wedding were Kirillov and Pyotr Verkhovyansky, who just happened to be in Petersburg then, as well as Lebyadkin himself and Prokhor Malov, who's since died. No one else knew anything about it, and those present gave their word to keep silent. This silence always seemed somewhat disgusting to me, but hasn't been broken up to now, even though I've been intending to make it public. Now I do make it public, along with all the rest. After I got married, I left to visit my mother in the provinces. I went for some distraction because the situation was intolerable. In our town, I left behind the idea that I was insane, an idea that still persists to this day and undoubtedly continues to do me harm. I'll explain more about that later. Then I went abroad and lived there 4 years. I went to the east, stood through 8 hours of an all-night service at Mount Athos, was in Egypt, lived in Switzerland, even visited Iceland. I sat through a whole year's course in Göttingen. During the last year, I became very close to a family of Russian nobles in Paris and to 2 young Russian ladies in Switzerland. 2 years ago in Frankfurt, passing a stationery shop, I noticed among the photographs on sale a small picture of a little girl dressed in a splendid child's dress but looking very much like Matryosha. I bought the picture immediately, and when I got to my hotel, placed it on the mantelpiece. It remained there untouched 1 whole week. I didn't even glance at it. When I left Frankfurt, I forgot to take it with me. I mention this precisely to show to what extent I could control my recollections and how indifferent I'd become towards them. I used to reject them all en masse, and they would obediently disappear each time en masse as soon as I wanted. I always found it boring to recollect the past and could never talk about it as most other people do. As far as Matryosha is concerned, I even forgot her picture on the mantel. About a year or so ago in the springtime, as I was traveling through Germany, I absent-mindedly missed the station where I was supposed to change trains and found myself on a different line. I got off at the next stop. It was past 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a clear day. I was in a tiny little German town. They directed me to the hotel. I had to wait. The next train was due at 11 o'clock that evening. I was actually quite pleased with my adventure, since I was in no hurry to get anywhere in particular. The hotel turned out to be shabby and small, but surrounded by greenery and flower beds. They gave me a very small room. I had an excellent meal. Since I'd been on the road all the previous night, I fell fast asleep after dinner, somewhere around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I had a dream that was totally unexpected, because I'd never had one like it before. In a gallery in Dresden, there's a painting by Claude Lorrain, called, I believe, in the catalogue, Acis and Galatea, although I've always referred to it as the Golden Age, I don't know why. I'd seen it before, but just about 3 days earlier, I'd noticed it once again in passing. It was this picture that appeared to me in my dream. Not as a picture, but as if it were the real thing. It was some little place in the Greek archipelago. There were gentle blue waves, islands and cliffs, a luxuriant shore, a fantastic panorama in the distance, a beckoning setting sun, beyond description. One was reminded of the cradle of European civilization, the first scenes of mythology, of the earthly paradise. What a splendid race lived here! They woke up and fell asleep happy and innocent. The groves were filled with their merry songs. Their abundant, untiring energy went into love and simple joys. The sun flooded the islands and sea with its rays, taking delight in its beautiful children. A wonderful dream, a lofty delusion. The most improbable fantasy ever conceived, to which all mankind has devoted its strength throughout its life, for which it sacrificed everything, for which men have died on the cross and prophets have been killed, without which people do not wish to live, but are unable even to die. I seemed to experience all these sensations in this dream. I don't know what it was that I dreamt precisely, but the cliffs and sea, the slanted rays of the setting sun, all this I still seemed to see when I woke up and opened my eyes, for the first time in my life, literally awash with tears. A feeling of happiness as yet unknown to me invaded my heart until it hurt. Evening had set in. Into the window of my little room, through the greenery of the flowers standing on the sill, shone a whole cluster of the setting sun's bright, slanting rays, bathing me in light. I closed my eyes again quickly, as if yearning to recapture my passing dream, but suddenly, amidst the very bright sunlight, I noticed a very small spot. It acquired a shape, and all of a sudden, I clearly saw a tiny red spider. At once, I recalled the one on the geranium leaf, when the slanting rays of the setting sun were pouring down in the same way. Something seemed to pierce me. I raised myself and sat up in bed. All, you see, just as it had happened the other time. I saw before me, oh, not in reality, if only they had been real, I saw Matryosha, emaciated, with feverish eyes, exactly as she was when she stood at my door, shaking her head and raising her tiny little fist at me. Nothing had ever tortured me so. The pitiful despair of a helpless 10-year-old child with its undeveloped mind, threatening me. With what? What could she possibly do to me? But blaming only herself, of course. Nothing like this had ever happened to me before. I sat there until nightfall, without moving, forgetting the time. Is this what's called remorse or repentance? I don't know, and to this day can't tell. Perhaps it's not the recollection of the act that I find so loathsome even now. Perhaps even now that recollection contains something that appeals to my passions. No, what I find intolerable is solely this image, namely her, in the doorway, threatening me with her raised fist, just her appearance at that moment, that 1 minute, That shake of her head. That's what I can't stand, because that's what I've been seeing ever since, almost every day. It doesn't come of its own accord. I summon it, and can't help doing so, although I can't live with it. Oh, if only I could see her in reality, even in the form of an hallucination. I have other memories of the past that perhaps go one better than this one. I treated a certain woman worse, and she died as a result. I took the lives of two innocent men in duels. Once I was mortally offended, and didn't take revenge on my enemy. I have won, poisoning to my credit, deliberate, successful, and completely undiscovered. If necessary, I am willing to make a full report. But why doesn't a single one of these memories make me feel anything similar? They make me feel only hatred, and that's inspired by my present situation, whereas at the time I would forget and dismiss it all cold-bloodedly. After that I wandered around for almost an entire year and tried to find something to do. I know I could dismiss that little girl from my mind even now if I wanted to. I'm in complete control of my own will, as always. But the whole point is that I never have wanted to do that. I don't want to now, and I never will want to. I know that by now. So it'll go on right up to the point where I go mad. 2 months later in Switzerland, I was able to fall in love with a young woman, or rather, I felt an access of passion accompanied by a savage impulse such as I always used to have to begin with. I felt a horrible temptation to commit another crime. Bigamy, I mean, because I was already married. But I fled on the advice of another young woman to whom I had confessed almost everything. Besides, this new crime would in no way have spared me Matryosha. Therefore, I decided to have these pages printed and bring 300 copies of them back to Russia. When the time comes, I will send them to the police and the local authorities. At the same time, I'll send them to the editors of all newspapers with a request to publish them and to a large number of my acquaintances in Petersburg and throughout Russia. It will appear at the same time in translation abroad. I know that legally I may have nothing to fear, at least nothing major. I'm the only person to inform against me, and there's no one to accuse me. Besides, there's no evidence, or very little. Finally, there's the widespread idea that I'm not in my right mind, an idea that my family will try to use to quash any legal proceedings that might threaten me. I am declaring all this, by the way, as proof that I'm in my right mind and understand my situation. But as far as I'm concerned, there'll always be some people who know everything, who'll look at me, and I at them. And the more of these people there are, the better. I don't know if it'll be any help to me. For me, it's the last resort. I repeat, if a very thorough search were made by the Petersburg police, something might turn up. Her family may still be in Petersburg. The house, of course, will be remembered. It was light blue. I'm not going anywhere, and will be at Mother's estate in Skvoreshniki for some time, a year or two. If required, I will come forward. Anywhere. Nikolai Stavrogin. Reading this lasted almost an hour. Tichon read slowly, and may have read several places a second time. All the while Stavrogin sat in silence, not stirring. It was strange, but the signs of impatience, absent-mindedness, and as it were delirium evident in his countenance all that morning had almost disappeared, to be replaced by serenity and, as it were, by a kind of sincerity that lent him an almost dignified air. Tichon took off his glasses and began to speak first with considerable caution. "Might it be possible to make some changes in this document?"
"Why? I was writing sincerely," Stavrogin replied.
"Maybe some of the style."
"I forgot to warn you that anything you say will be in vain. I won't set aside my intention. Don't bother trying to persuade me."
"No. You didn't forget to warn me about this earlier, before I read it."
"All the same, I'll say it again. Whatever the force of your objections, I won't back down from my intention. Note that by this fortunate or unfortunate phrase, think what you will, I'm by no means trying to encourage you to make objections or attempt to prevail upon me," he added, as if unable to control himself, and suddenly returning for a moment to his previous tone, but then, all at once, smiling gloomily at his own words.
"I would not dream of objecting, let alone prevailing on you to forsake your intention. This idea of yours is a very fine one. The Christian idea could not find more complete expression. Repentance cannot go further than the astonishing feat you've conceived. Only assuming it is genuine repentance and a genuine Christian idea.
You seem to be splitting hairs. Isn't it the same thing? I wrote it in all sincerity.
It's as if you deliberately wanted to make yourself out worse than your heart would desire," said Tichon, growing bolder and bolder. Obviously the document had made a strong impression on him.
"Make myself out? I repeat, I didn't make myself out anything, and I certainly wasn't striking a pose."
Tichon quickly lowered his eyes. "This document is the direct expression of a heart that's been mortally wounded. Do I understand it correctly?" he persisted with unusual enthusiasm. "Yes, it's repentance and the natural need for it that's overcome you. And you've entered upon a great path, an unprecedented path. But you seem to hate in advance all those who'll read what you've written, and you're summoning them to battle. You weren't ashamed to confess your crime. Why are you ashamed of your repentance? Let them look at me, you say. Well, but you, how will you look at them? Some parts of your statement are brought into relief by the style. It's as if you revel in your own psychology and latch on to every trivial detail merely to astonish the reader with an insensitivity you don't really have. What is this but the arrogant challenge of the guilty party to the judge?
Where's the challenge? I've kept any discussion of my own person out of it."
Tichon was silent. His pale cheeks had flushed.
"Let's leave this," Stavrogin said sharply. "Let me put you a question. 5 minutes have passed since that," he nodded at the pages, "yet I see no expression of disgust or shame in you. You can't be very squeamish."
He didn't finish and burst out laughing. "You mean you would have liked me to express my contempt sooner?" Tichon concluded resolutely. "I won't conceal anything from you. I was horrified by so great an amount of idle energy intentionally wasted on filth. As for the crime itself, many other people sin the same way. But they live in peace and harmony with their consciences, regarding crimes of that sort as inevitable youthful peccadillos. There are even elders of the church who sin the same way, even quite comfortably, frivolously. The whole world is filled with these horrors. But you've experienced the utter depths, and that very rarely happens to such a degree."
"Surely you haven't begun to respect me after reading these pages, have you?" Stavrogin asked with a wry smile.
"I won't reply directly on that score. But of course there isn't, and can never be, a greater or more terrible crime than the one you committed against that little girl."
"Let's stop measuring by yardsticks. I'm somewhat surprised by your mention of other people and the ordinariness of such a crime. Perhaps I've not suffered as much as I've described here, and perhaps I've really told a great many lies about myself," he added unexpectedly.
Tichon was silent once more.
Stavrogin didn't even think of leaving. On the contrary, he began to lapse again into brief moments of deep thought.
"And this girl," Tichon began again very timidly,
with whom you broke off in Switzerland. If I may be so bold to ask, where is she at the moment?
Here.
Once again, silence. Perhaps I told you a great many lies about myself, Stavrogin repeated insistently. Besides, what does it matter if I offer a challenge by the crudeness of my confession, given that you noticed the challenge? I'll force them to despise me even more, that's all. Then it'll be easier for me.
You mean their hatred will arouse yours? And in hating, it'll be easier for you than if you had to endure their pity.
You're right, you know, he said, laughing suddenly. They may call me a Jesuit and a sanctimonious hypocrite, don't you think? Don't you think?
Of course there will be that reaction, too.
How soon do you plan to carry out your intention? Today, tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, how should I know? But very soon. You're right, I think it'll happen just that way. I'll announce it all of a sudden, precisely at some vengeful, malicious moment when I hate them most of all.
Answer me one question, but sincerely to me alone. If someone forgave you for this,
Tichon indicated the sheets of paper, not someone you respect or fear, but a stranger, a person you'll never know, someone who read your terrible confession to himself in silence,
would the thought of that make it any easier for you? Or would it be all the same?
It would make it easier, Stavrogin replied in a low voice, dropping his eyes. If you were to forgive me, it would make it much easier for me, he added unexpectedly and in a whisper.
On the condition that you forgive me as well,
Tichon replied in a voice full of emotion.
For what? What have you done to me?
Ah, yes, isn't that a monastic formula?
For the intended and the unintended. Having sinned, each man has sinned against all men, and each man is responsible in some way for the sins of others. There is no isolated sin. I'm a great sinner, perhaps even greater than you.
I'll tell you the whole truth. I want you to forgive me, and a second and third person too, but not everyone. It'd be better if everyone else hated me, but I want it in order to suffer in humility.
But you couldn't suffer universal pity in that same kind of humility.
Perhaps I couldn't. You grasp all the subtleties. But why are you doing this?
I sense the degree of your sincerity, and of course, I'm much to blame for not being able to get close to people. I've always felt this to be my great failing,
Tichon said sincerely and intimately, looking Stavrogin straight in the eye.
I'm doing it only because I'm terribly afraid for you, he added. There's an almost impassable abyss before you.
You think I won't endure? I won't bear their hatred with humility?
Not only their hatred.
What else?
Their laughter.
Tichon's half-whispered reply seemed dragged out of him. Stavrogin was embarrassed. His face revealed anxiety. I knew you'd say that, he replied. So you must consider me a comic figure after reading my document in spite of all the tragedy. Don't be alarmed or disconcerted. I had a premonition this would occur.
The horror will be universal, and, of course, more put on than genuine. People only fear what directly threatens their own interests. I'm not talking about good people. They'll be horrified and accuse themselves, but they'll go unnoticed.
The laughter will be widespread.
And add the philosopher's comment that in another's woes there is always something gratifying.
That's a true thought.
However, you yourself, I'm surprised by the low opinion you have of other people. How loathsome you find them.
Stavrogin uttered with some bitterness. Believe me, when I said that I was judging by myself rather than talking about other people,
Tychon exclaimed. Really? Don't tell me there's something in your soul which makes you rejoice in my misfortune.
Who knows? Perhaps there is. Oh, perhaps there is.
Enough. Show me precisely how I appear ridiculous in my manuscript. I know, but I'd like you to show me. And tell me very cynically, with all the sincerity you're capable of. And, I repeat, you're a terribly queer fellow.
Even the form you cast your great penance in has something ridiculous about it. Oh, don't believe you won't win, he cried suddenly, almost in rapture. Even this form will triumph. He indicated the sheets of paper. If you sincerely accept the insults and abuse. It's always been the way that the most ignominious cross ends by becoming a great glory and strength, if the humility of the deed is sincere. You may even find consolation during your own lifetime.
So you think what's ridiculous is just in the form? In the style? Savrogin insisted.
And in the substance. The ugliness will kill it, Tychon whispered, lowering his eyes.
What? The ugliness? What ugliness?
Of the crime. There are genuinely ugly crimes. Crimes, whatever they are, the more blood and horror, the more impressive they are, the more they are, so to speak, picturesque. But there are crimes that are shameful and infamous beyond any horror, so to speak, too inelegant.
Tychon didn't complete his thought. You mean, Stavrogin interrupted him excitedly, you found me an extremely ridiculous figure when I kissed the little girl's dirty foot. And everything I said about my temperament, well, and everything else.
I understand.
I understand you very well, and you're in despair over me precisely because it's so ugly and loathsome. No, not loathsome, but shameful and ridiculous. And you think that's what I won't be able to bear?
Tychon remained silent.
Yes, you do know people. That is, you know I won't bear it. Now I understand why you asked if that young lady from Switzerland was here.
You're not prepared. Not hardened.
Tychon whispered timidly, lowering his eyes. Listen, Father Tychon, I want to forgive myself. That's my principal aim, my entire aim, Savrogin said suddenly with gloomy rapture in his eyes. I know that only then will the apparition disappear. That's why I'm searching for immeasurable suffering, why I'm searching myself for it. Don't frighten me.
If you believe that you can forgive yourself and obtain that forgiveness for yourself in this world, then you already believe everything.
Tychon cried in rapture. How can you say you don't believe in God?
Savrogin didn't answer.
God will forgive you for your unbelief, since you honor the Holy Spirit without knowing it.
By the way, Christ won't forgive, will he? Savrogin asked with a slight trace of irony in the tone of his question. For isn't it written, Whoso shall offend one of these little ones? Do you remember? According to the gospel, there's no greater crime, nor can there be. Why, it's in that book. He pointed to the gospel.
I bring you joyful news in that regard, Tychon said with tender emotion. Christ will also forgive, if only you reach the point where you forgive yourself. Oh, no, no, don't believe it. I do him wrong. Even if you don't achieve reconciliation with yourself and forgiveness for yourself, even then he will forgive you for your intention and for your great suffering. For there is no word, no thought in human language to express all the ways and paths of the Lamb of God, until his ways are revealed unto us. Who can embrace him, the boundless one? Who can fathom everything, the infinite?
The corners of his mouth turned down as they had before, and a barely perceptible shudder crossed his face again. After regaining control of himself a moment later, he couldn't maintain it and dropped his eyes. Stavrogin picked up his hat from the sofa.
I'll come again sometime, he said, with an air of extreme exhaustion. You and I very much appreciate the pleasure of your conversation, and the honor, and your feelings. Believe me, I understand why others love you so much. I ask for your prayers to him whom you love so much.
Are you leaving already?
Tychon asked quickly and stood up, as if he hadn't really expected such an immediate farewell.
But I... He seemed clustered. I was just about to make a request of you, but I don't know how, and now I'm afraid.
Oh, I beg you, please do, said Stavrogin, sitting down at once, his hat still in his hand. Tichon observed his hat and his demeanor, the demeanor of a man who'd suddenly assumed a certain urbanity, who was in turmoil and half crazy, and was giving him 5 minutes to complete their business, and he became even more confused.
My entire request is simply that you... But you're already aware, Nikolai Vsevolodovitch, that's your name and patronymic, isn't it, that if you publish these sheets of paper, you'll destroy your own future, in terms of a career, for example, and in terms of everything else.
My career? Nikolai Vsevolodovitch replied, frowning unpleasantly.
Why spoil it? Why such inflexibility?
Tichon concluded, almost pleading, clearly aware of his own awkwardness. An expression of pain appeared on Nikolai Vsevolodovitch's face. I've already asked you, and I'll ask you again. Whatever you say will be to no avail, and I'm starting to find our conversation intolerable. He turned around in the armchair impressively.
You don't understand me. Hear me out, and don't get irritated. You know my opinion. Your deed, if performed out of humility, would constitute the greatest Christian feat if you could endure. Even if you didn't, the Lord would still take into account your original sacrifice. Everything is taken into account. Not a single word, not a single movement of the Spirit, not a single thought is wasted. But I suggest you exchange one kind of heroic deed for another, even greater, something undoubtedly grand.
Nikolai Vsevolodovitch was silent.
You're struggling with a desire for martyrdom and self-sacrifice. Overcome this desire of yours, put aside those sheets of paper and your intention, then you'll overcome everything. You'll disgrace your own pride and your devil. You'll end up the victor and will achieve freedom.
His eyes sparkled. He clasped his hands in front of him as if pleading. The simple truth is that you really don't want a scandal, and you're laying a trap for me, good Father Tichon. Stavrogin mumbled carelessly and in annoyance, making as if to stand up. In brief, you'd like me to settle down, perhaps even get married, and end my life as a member of the local club, visiting your monastery on every holiday. Well, now that would be real penance. But as an expert on the human heart, perhaps you do anticipate that all this will actually come to pass, and all your sincere entreaties are merely for form's sake, since it is really what I myself desire, am I right? He gave a self-conscious chuckle.
No, not that kind of voluntary penance. I'm preparing another one for you.
Tichon continued with ardor, not paying the least attention to Stavrogin's laughter or what he said.
I know an elder, not here, but not far from here, a hermit and ascetic, in possession of such Christian wisdom that you and I cannot begin to understand. He'll honor my requests. I'll tell him everything about you. Go to him and become a novice. Remain under his supervision for 5 or 7 years, as long as you yourself find necessary. Take a vow, and by this greater sacrifice, you'll get to possess everything you desire, beyond even what you expect, for you can't even imagine now what you'll gain.
Stavrogin listened very, very gravely to this last proposition. You're simply suggesting I become a monk in that monastery? Much as I respect you, I should have expected this. Well, I must confess that in several pusillanimous moments, the thought had already occurred to me that once I'd published these pages for all to see, I'd hide away from people in a monastery, even if only for a little while. But I would immediately blush for such baseness. But to take the tonsure and become a monk? That idea never entered my head, even in moments of the most extreme pusillanimous fear.
You don't have to be in a monastery. You don't have to take the tonsure. You'd only be a novice in secret. In private, you could continue living in the world.
Stop it, Father Tichon, Stavrogin said, interrupting him in disgust. And he stood up. So did Tichon.
What's wrong with you?
He cried suddenly, looking at Tichon almost in fear. The latter stood before him, his hands clasped in front of him, and a sickly shudder as if he had some terrible shock flickered across his face.
What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you?
Stavrogin repeated, rushing forward to support him. He thought Father Tichon was about to fall.
I see as if it were real, Tichon exclaimed in a voice that
pierced the soul and with an expression of the most heartfelt grief. That you, you poor, lost young man, have never been so close to committing a most terrible crime as you are at this very moment.
Calm down, Stavrogin repeated, really alarmed about him. Perhaps I can still put it aside. You're right, I may not be able to endure, and in my spite I'll commit some new crime. Oh, that's true, you're right, I'll put it aside.
No, not after publishing these pages, but before, a day, an hour perhaps, before taking this great step. You'll throw yourself into some new crime as a means of escape, simply to avoid publishing these pages.
Stavrogin actually began to tremble with rage, and almost from fear.
You damned psychologist, he said, cutting him short suddenly in a fury.
And he left the cell without so much as a backward glance.